This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. As prostitution has become an ever-heated debate, the voices of women who actually survived the industry have grown louder and stronger. This year, a new book containing testimonies written by survivors was published by Spinifex Press. Prostitution Narratives, Stories of Survival in the Sex Trade, Busts Myths, reveals the trauma experienced by those who are used and abused by Johns, and raises hope as we hear from women who turned the personal into the political and are fighting back. This week, I spoke with co-editor Melinda Tankard-Reist and two survivors who shared their stories in the book, Simone Watson and Charlotte, over Skype. Here is that interview. Thank you so much for making the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
It's an honor. We all love your work. As you know, we're all total fangirls.
I love your work also, and I'm loving this book that you guys put together.
Oh, thank you so much.
You know, as somebody who's published a lot of content about the harms of prostitution and the Nordic model, I've noticed myself, especially recently, that a common response in defense of the legalization or full decriminalization of prostitution is, look at Australia. The Australian model is so great. Everything is so great here. Melinda, I wonder if maybe you can first just tell me a little bit about the legislation surrounding prostitution in Australia and what the industry is like there.
Well, look, it's a myth to say that things are better here. And there's a mix of legislation. It's a state-by-state approach. Some have decriminalized, some have legalized. But for all intents and purposes, really, it's an unregulated industry. The industry is pretty much allowed to do what it wants. In Victoria, Mary Lucille Sullivan wrote a remarkable work called Making Sex Work, The Failure of Legalized Prostitution in Victoria. And in that book, she critiqued all of the claims that were made leading up to legalization, that you'd have less violence, you'd have less drug offenses, less, weapons, illegal trade. And she blew every claim out of the water post the law change there and showed how things had got worse. And often, in fact, it was the same people who owned the legal brothels and the illegal brothels, that illegal brothels spring up anywhere there is less regulation of the industry. So it's a myth to look at us as some kind of, sex industry paradise. And the stories in the book also refute those lies, the level of violence, the level of coercion, the manipulation, the tricks that were used to get women into the industry, the way vulnerable women were preyed upon, and the lack of exit programs, which is just an absolute scandal in this country. Simone may be able to say more about the legislation side of it as well.
Yeah, I'm spot on with all of that, Melinda. I think it's also really important to know that the Red Umbrella Groups, the pro-sex trade lobby, are consistently saying that they don't want legalisation anymore because they're aware of how it's failed in so many places. So they're really pushing for full decriminalisation because that has even less regulation. So with say, for example, trafficked women, if you've got in New South Wales, it's just like a paradise. I mean, it's a paradise for pimps in Victoria, but in New South Wales, because they have decriminalisation, you can have pop-up brothels and people can't find these places because they'll show up anywhere and then they disappear and then they pop up again. And it's sort of, they want the New Zealand model sort of. So where it's been legalised, it's sort of like they're even, the Scarlet Alliance and these groups are going, oh, but that's not what we want anymore. We don't want that now, because, and I'll look at New Zealand, you know, and New Zealand's just become this hellhole now, and they're still focusing on New Zealand more and more as this paradise. And of course, the exploitation of Maori and Pacific Islander girls has just gone through the roof. And it's just a Pimp and John's paradise, really. And just even on a practical level, the wages have gone down. Women are getting paid less. It's a full service that the women have to provide now.
In New Zealand or in Australia you're talking about?
In New Zealand particularly, it's, you know, they have brothels set up there that are legal, and you don't get to negotiate anymore. And I think I would probably side with people like Rachel Moore, and if I was absolutely, totally forced to do prostitution again, I'd do it on the street because you can negotiate better. And if people are profiting from what you're doing, as they are in New Zealand, and it's saying that everyone's autonomous and, you know, empowered, it's just a fabrication and a lie. And if someone can make money off women's bodies, they will. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, it would be street prostitution. It's horrible, disgusting, dangerous, but it's better than being controlled by a third party.
Mm-hmm. Megan, can I just clarify something there? And so when I said if people think it's a sex industry paradise, what I meant was, you know, a paradise for anyone in the industry. It is, in as Simone said, it's a paradise for those who profit. So it's a paradise for the vested interest, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But painting it as a great place, you know, for women to be in the industry is a lie. So I just wanted to clarify that in case there was any confusion.
Right, yes. Thank you. Okay, and so, Charlotte, in your chapter, you explain that you were lured into, or they tried to lure you into stripping under the guise of a bar job that you'd applied for. I wonder if this is common in Australia, that girls are kind of tricked in this way.
Oh, I know it is in the state where I live currently. That's absolutely how they get the girls to work. They advertise solely for bar positions. And when you get there, they all of a sudden there is no bar work and there never was any bar work. But they turn around and say, oh, but we've got dancing work available. And I heard through other friends that that's how it works in other states as well. I mean, once you're there, you're already pretty desperate. You've made the decision to stay. You're pretty vulnerable and you're pretty likely that to say, okay, well, I'll give it a go. I'm here already. And they know that.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't return to that job in any case. You did it for one night and then left and didn't come back, but you instead got into webcamming. Can you tell me what that was like and the impact that that had on you?
At first, it actually did feel there was a sort of false sense of empowerment because it really was like being your own boss. You know, I could work whenever I want, and there was this sudden cash flow and I didn't have to give, you know, half my wage over to a manager and to a boss or a pimp. And so, yeah, so the first few days it was great and it really was that sort of sense of replaying the childhood trauma that I went through, you know, I've got the power. I can turn the camera off at any moment. You know, you're telling me take my top off now, but I don't have to. I can do it whenever I want. And, yeah, there really was this sense of I have the power as the girl over you, the guy. What a fool you are. You're paying me all this money for me to do nothing because it meant nothing to me. Doing that sort of stuff meant nothing. I had no self-worth. I didn't care. I just used to think how stupid the guys were, you know. They were paying me money to do stuff that I didn't care about. But that wore off pretty quickly. I mean, especially once you start getting sort of people wanting more and more disgusting things, pushing the boundaries, being a lot more abusive. You see you get a lot of people, I think because there's more of a sense of anonymity, they tell you things that they wouldn't tell other people. So I had a lot of people say, you know, they'd sort of confess their attraction to, you know, prepubescent girls and say, you know, oh, well, I can't do this in the real world, so I'm coming to you to do it because you look prepubescent to me. Or, yeah, just the more violent requests. So the more of that I was getting, so that sort of happened around the second week, then that facade of I have all this power, I feel so in control, that fell away very quickly and I just felt abused again. Especially once I started having people sort of blackmail me and say, you know, I'm going to keep your pictures and if you don't keep giving us what we want, then I will give these to all your family and friends. And I mean, I'm not an educated person and I took all the precautions that I could think of. You know, I made sure there was nothing identifying in any of the photos. Like I hid all of my tattoos. There was nothing. I made sure you couldn't see out the windows so people couldn't see where I was. I took everything down on my walls. But, I mean, I don't know what these people are capable of, so I believe them. And, yeah, I felt trapped. And I thought, you know, they probably can find out who I am. And, yeah, so I felt compelled and re-victimized and just...
And, Charlotte, you later started working in a massage parlor.
Correct.
And Simone, you also worked in a massage parlor, too. And, Charlotte, you had said that the owners liked that you looked underage. And
yeah.
Did you find that men really cared a lot about the age or perceived age of the women they paid for sex?
Yes.
What would they say?
Obviously, not all of the men cared about the age, but a lot of them did. And they would comment on the fact that, oh, you look like you could be my daughter's age, or, oh, you look like you're in high school still, or, you know, or, yeah, they would comment on the fact that they liked that I looked young, or you look too young to be working here, just...
I mean, what I find interesting partly is that pro-legalization advocates never, or full decriminalization, I should say, also, they never discuss the fact that men are so often looking for young or young-looking women. And
yeah,
why do you think that is? I mean, what do you think it says about prostitution that men... are looking for girls that look like teenagers?
Oh, I had so many of them say to me that I have these urges and I come here because I don't want to act on them in the real world and go to jail. But I can come here and pretend that you're 13 and, you know, get off. And I'm not going to get in trouble for it. They felt like they could act out their pedophilic fantasies there, and it felt safer for them. But, yeah, I guess for those people advocating for that, they don't want to go anywhere near that because that's just another...
Well, you see them in the adult sex shops, you know. I remember being with my daughter when she was 12 and she'd been reading all the Alice in Wonderland books for a couple of years and loved them, you know, how people get obsessed with them. And we walked past and there's one of those adult sex shops and there was a costume on a mannequin of Alice in Wonderland clothing. And I remember her just stopping dead in her tracks and because she knew what the shop was and just saying, Mum, they mean me. They mean me. Mm. And it was a really horrific experience and it's promoted like that. There's a sex shop and there's a little dress, you know, like a 12-year-old girl's dress for women to wear. And that really stood out in my mind, you know, as a mother. I was just set my daughter's reaction to that, you know, and I marched in and gave them what for. But anyway.
Yeah, it's totally gross. And I mean, I guess I'm trying to get at what that says about Johns. And I mean, it says something about our larger culture, but what does it say about the men who seek out women and girls to pay for sex? Anyone can answer if anyone has an answer.
Well, I think the thing is they're not, they are focused, that of course the market starts younger and young, very, very young. But as Charlotte was saying, you know, there is a market out there for everybody. So there's middle-aged women that they go for. If you're particularly thin, if you're obese, if you're an amputee, it's fetishization. I think that there may be something very different in the pedophilia, you know, realm of wanting children, that may be more egregious, but there is a market for everyone. And I think with the cosmetics industry and everything saying that we have to be young and thin and things like that to be attractive to men, actually men with fetishes who do this, well, if that's what you, if you're interested in just being sexually available to men, there is a man somewhere who will pay to rape you, whatever your ability, disability, however you look. They might like women who have got bad teeth. It's the perversity is just bizarre across the board, and a lot of women don't understand that.
Mm-hmm. And prostitution is often sold by the media and the pro-prostitution lobby as like this great way to make money, you know, to help young women through college and things like that. But Simone, you didn't really find this to be the case, despite the fact that you worked in high-end brothels. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think this is quite a common experience, that I started out with the idea of, well, this is really excellent money, and I was rolling in money. And there was something about it that I just wanted to get rid of it. It wasn't just that I was bad with money. It was sort of like wanting to sort of get rid of this money and the emotional toll. And for example, because of where I was, you know, I wasn't sort of sitting around drunk all day. You had to be on the ball. And at nighttime, I would go out, or I'd go home and I'd drink a lot of alcohol and I wanted to be with friends. So I'd spend a lot of money on other people. I'd buy people presents. And I didn't have, and I was sort of applied to get into uni, and I got into uni, and I had, but I couldn't cope with it. I couldn't cope with the normality of it. I felt very much like a freak. I mean, the pro-sex trade will say, oh, this is all about stigma. And there's always going to be a stigma around it, but it really isn't the stigma. It's just that I was living such an experience that I couldn't relate to other people in that. And I was, you know, from a lovely family, and because this was so normalised, I didn't trust my feelings on it. And so just things don't materialise. You know, I was going to get a car, and I was going to go, you know, I was saving up to go back overseas, and I was going to be out of this soon. And this is just such a common story. And then once you start, if you need to take things like, I never got into heavy drugs, but I needed benzodiazepines immediately. Once you get into that, you dissociate, you disconnect, you can't study. It all sort of falls away. And I'm aware that there are some women who have been able to forge an income, and a lot of the time it's been by becoming pimps themselves, you know, like moving themselves out of the market. I don't know how they do it, but they're a minority, and we hear from them a lot, calling themselves sex workers when they've actually gone into, collecting government funding and the Scarlet Alliance and ensuring and propping up the industry, making sure there are more young women coming into it. Sort of very oftentimes it's anything but this, and I'm going to forge a better life for myself. I'll only do it for a few years. I'm going to have all this cash. I'll put a deposit on a unit, and then I'll always have a home. And, you know, here I am all these years later on a disability pension trying to pay my rent, mm-hmm. and I don't work. So being alive is great. That's all I can say for it.
If I could throw in there, Megan, the conference on prostitution that we held at RMIT University in Melbourne in April, it was weirdly fascinating to see protesters turn up representing the sex industry and the Australian Sex Party. They actually turned up to the wrong venue because we gave out a fake address. But they held banners that said, "Why be poor?" which is just this myth, you know, and even at an event like that, they were trying to recruit, you know, why be poor? And yet none of the survivors who spoke at the conference said that they were, you know, enjoying this wonderful, luxurious lifestyle. All of them, and it ended up in, you know, struggling and trying to survive, really. And the industry didn't set them up for life or, you know, meet all the promises that it made. But, yeah, that myth continues. And in Australia, we have a situation where our government is giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Scarlet Alliance under the guise of fighting trafficking through our anti-trafficking initiatives, where Scarlet Alliance is on the record as saying there's no trafficking in Australia. And yet there is no ongoing funding for exit programs in Australia. So massive double standards. And I'm about to interview a woman who worked for Scarlet Alliance, and she told me that, well, she hasn't told me yet, sorry. I'm about to interview a woman who worked for Scarlet Alliance who wanted to help women to get out. She said she had to field hundreds of calls from women wanting to exit the industry, and she was told, that's not what we're here for. We're not allowed to help women to get out. We're here just to keep them in, and she couldn't deal with that anymore and left. So I just wanted to get that in there somewhere.
Thank you.
The Scarlet Alliance had been around for a few years when I was in prostitution, in legal prostitution. And the only time I heard from them when I was in prostitution was when I got out. And their absolute vilification of me now in speaking the truth and the reality about prostitution, they will not support you if you want to leave. Anyone can join if you're a former sex worker, as they call them, you can join, but they won't let you join unless you agree with the expansion of the sex trade.
Can I quote Jade here, who was prostituted in New Zealand? She makes a really profound point. She describes how she wanted to get out, but she was given no help. She says, after 5 years, I wanted out of the sex industry. Twice I tried to go to school. I wanted to be a youth worker, but I couldn't study due to drugs and sex work. None of the sex work advocacy agencies ever offered a contingency to get me out of the sex industry. They supplied lawyers, health checks, lube, condoms, and dams, but nothing to help me get out.
Interesting. Yeah. Simone, you wrote that you didn't know what was worse, the prostitution you endured or having to listen to people defend it now. What's so difficult about having to listen to people defend prostitution?
Because it's so toxic and noxious, it's sort of like, imagine people defending, you know, the water in Flint, Michigan, is it? You know, saying, oh, we really love this. This is great. This is empowering. And it's the cognitive dissonance of the public. I think it's true. We were talking about this the other day, I think, on the internet, you know, and there was an article talking about the use of language. People hear the term decriminalization and they think of positive images. They think of something positive, like, say, decriminalizing the use of marijuana for personal use or for medical reasons or for whatever. I don't know if the law's the same. Sorry to sort of, it seems tangential, but I think it's really relevant. I don't know about how it is now in Western Australia, but prostitution used to come under the gaming, racing and liquor legislation, and which, you know, is all recreational activities. So people see decriminalisation of this as empowering the women, as if we on the same levels of, say, marijuana or anything else. If anything, we're like spoken of as, in terms of the RSPCA, like a special breed of animal. And I think people hear that word decriminalise and they go, yeah, because it'll make it all safer and regulated. And the opposite happens. And, of course, we should be decriminalised, but if we don't criminalise the buyers and the pimps, and then the government has no impetus to give us exiting strategies. And this just increases the demand. And when the majority of people actually want to get out, I don't know. And I think it just eases the cognitive dissonance of people who want to sound cool and they want to support someone who says that they're oppressed. And, in fact, what they're doing is catering to the pimps. And they don't know that. And I find it so frustrating and hurtful because someone only needs to wave a plaque and a red umbrella and say, sex worker rights are human rights, and then people forget all the rest. Mm-hmm. That the majority of these human beings are suffering human rights violations, and they just don't get it the way they would in any other industry.
Mm-hmm. And Melinda, you and Carol and Norma wrote in the intro to Prostitution Narratives that stories about survivors are rarely published, but that rather this sex work is work, and, you know, like you just said, Simone, sex worker rights are human rights. These lines get tons of press, unchallenged, uncontested. Why is this?
Mm. Well, there's a dominant narrative, and it serves the vested interests of the global sex industry. You know, we are trying to contend here with a multi-billion dollar sexual exploitation industry built upon the backs of the bodies of real women and girls. We've got a situation here in Australia where, you know, any time we try and launch the book, sex industry people turn up and demand a platform and demand a stage and try to take the microphone. You know, like, we can't even launch the book without some attempted disruption. And we're saying, well, look, this is our launch, and these are voices being represented, you know, in this country essentially for the first time. You know, you can't take over everything. At major events like the Festival of Dangerous Ideas at the Opera House for authors, they took over the stage. They dominated the question time. There's attempts to get me out of the Melbourne Writers' Festival and the Canberra Writers' Festival, which is coming up. They're outraged that, as the co-editor of this book, I've been, you know, given a platform there. So, you know, it won't surprise me if they turn up en masse there and try to disrupt. They do not want alternative voices heard. They only want the voices which fits the narrative, which underpins and supports the profits of the industry. And they're trying to silence our women. You know, every day our women have to run a gauntlet of abuse, being told that they've sold out, you know, that they're traitors. And that's why we admire our survivors just so much for their bravery. They keep showing up. They keep coming to the events. We just admire them for their strength and their bravery so much.
And do you notice also that they do this? I mean, for example, when the Scarlet Alliance are offered an entire session to themselves, if I'm really passionate about a cause, so, you know, I'd really like to take on the, you know, the tree logging industry for our endangered forests, you use every platform that you are offered to get out there and speak about your cause. And I find that they just do this when they want to stir up some trouble.
They want to disrupt. They don't want their own event. They want to disrupt ours. No,
and I think if they really believed and they cared about these quote-unquote sex workers, they would take every opportunity to be as public as they can at these events. Instead, they turn them down because they just want to disrupt us.
Can I throw in something positive here? At the, because God knows we need it, at the Adelaide, South Australia launch of the book, so many remarkable things happened there. But one of them was that a woman approached me afterwards who I'd never met, and there'd been an attempt by sex industry lobby people to disrupt the launch. And she came up to me afterwards and she said, keep doing what you're doing. She said, I used to be part of that group. She said, I used to go from events like yours to other events, determined to disrupt. That was our role. We had to disrupt anything that your side wanted to do. She said, however, every time I was called out for that, every time I was confronted with the facts, she said, it became harder and harder to turn another trick. She said, the scales fell off my eyes and I couldn't keep lying to myself. And eventually she left the industry and sort of crossed over to the other side. So that's what she told me that night, you know, just to keep speaking out, keep, you know, supporting the survivors to speak out, and, you know, hopefully the realities and the truths would have an impact at some stage.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear. Thank you.
I mean, in terms of silencing survivor voices, when a lot of survivors are so fragile that when they do speak out, the tiniest little bit of dissonance and someone speaking out is often enough to sort of make that person crumble and retreat back to where they came from. And you're never going to hear from them again because their whole life they've been invalidated and told that, you know, what you're going through is normal, you know, being abused is part of the job, just shut up and get on with it. And for someone to, for them to come out and speak about their experiences is hard enough, and to just have one person criticize that, that's often enough for that person to go away and never speak about it again. And personally, when the book was released, I found these lobby groups, there were two main things that they would throw at me. Now, the first of these was that, oh, you're lying, you're making this up. Well, how do you want me to prove it? Like, half the places I worked at have shut down because a lot of these places don't stay open very long. I do have some photos and stuff from that time, but I'm not going to bring those out and show them to people. And second of all, and this to me is the most illogical argument, they would say to me, well, because you're not a current sex worker, you're not currently in the industry, what gives you the right to speak out about it? And I'm just like, that makes no sense. Like, so my experiences, because I'm not currently working, are suddenly invalidated. Like, they don't count and they're not true. Mm-hmm. Like, how about you? Are you currently working in the industry?
Yeah, such a good point, Charlotte. It's so infuriating. We listen to war veterans of the Iraq War, you know, men like in, you know, who have experienced the horrors of war, veterans, and they're respected. They are respected by people, but when it comes to our voices, it's like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about because you're not currently in it. Not to mention that a lot of these women who attack us, or these other people who attack us, can't have no evidence that they're actually current so-called sex workers now either.
But a lot of them also are men, and they've never had any experience working in the industry. But, like, I'm not going to throw back the same lines at them. I mean, sometimes I do, but it's not going to go anywhere. There's no point engaging in the argument because it's not even a logical argument to begin with. You'll just find yourself going around in circles. These people just want to get you. They just want to enrage you, and they want to fight. That's what they want. But, yeah, I think they know very well that survivors come out so damaged and so fragile that it doesn't take much to make someone completely fall apart and have lose all their courage to ever speak again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are also some of us who are going to put up with any stones that they want to throw. You know, keep throwing them because I'm not going away and I'm not going to be silenced. So bring it on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like at the Amnesty, when we went to protest the Amnesty International decision at the national AGM, like the annual general meeting, you know, at the Human Rights Conference in Melbourne, they were so vile. That the toughest of us had to flee the room. You know, I was vomiting outside of the Parliament House in Victoria. Other survivor girlfriend who is a full-on activist who has taken lots of beatings, who's been in the public arena, she was in absolute tears. And they don't mind, and they will sit there, and they will, it's almost a reptilian look, a soulless look of just, they will look at you and go, good, it's working, because it's an activist strategy. You know, they've read a handbook, they've been given a book on take whoever you can down. And the cruelty is absolutely shocking.
And, you know, along those lines, I wonder if you can both, Charlotte and Simone, talk about how speaking out publicly as a survivor has impacted you.
Sometimes I feel as though it's too early to tell. I think we had our first book launch in April. It's definitely been empowering in the true sense of the word, not this false empowerment that the sex industry will... wants you to believe that prostitution will give you, but genuine empowerment. It gives me hope. I'd like to believe that I'm, you know, opening people's eyes to what's really going on. I'd like to believe that I'm maybe giving some women who are still in the industry and are thinking that they can't get out or that nothing's going to change if they do get out. I'd like to think that maybe I'm getting through to some of them, or my message is getting to some of them, that there is a life after this, and you know, you can get out and start changing things and bringing some light into your life. Some days it's hard, you know, because it does bring all the trauma back, but that's going to happen anyway, regardless of whether I'm speaking. Overall, it's been really a really positive experience, despite anyone trying to silence me. Unfortunately for them, that only fuels my fire and my passion to speak out more. So, you know, if they were smart, they would shut up. But that doesn't seem to be the case, so...
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Simone?
It's been, you know, overall it's been sort of really, really brilliant, but it's been so full on for 2 years. And also I do notice that I can fall into traps. And like Charlotte was saying, I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. And because they'll pick on every single little word that you say, that can be used against you, it's really quite frightening. But what I did find was that it's so much better than closeting myself away with the trauma and not being able to talk about it. As Charlotte said, the trauma's there anyway. This gives us an opportunity to sort of face that head on. I wouldn't call it therapy or anything. So, I mean, I'm not doing it to get some therapy out of this. It's just that I wanted to be able to speak my experience. I could only think of the fully decriminalised model because it never occurred to me that we could abolish prostitution. And when I heard of the Nordic model, and then just being on the internet and finding that there are other women who had these same experiences, and people like Melinda and Caroline and yourself, who may not have been in the industry per se, but who are willing to listen, I found myself, you know, saying, okay, this is something I can be a part of. And with all my flaws and to be able to reach out and someone go, hey, I can relate to that and your anger is appropriate, it was the first time I'd ever sort of heard that before. Before it was just sort of sitting away reading, you know, books and ranting away to myself and feeling misunderstood and stupid. Mm. Absolutely, just the most, like I was the most stupid woman ever. I really felt dumb for feeling the way I did and thinking the way I did. So the main thing, I think it's incredibly hard. I wouldn't wish this activism on anyone, but the fact that there are women out there and some men out there as well, willing to take on voices that are, we've been damaged, we are traumatised, and to give us a voice, has really helped me immensely. And I just can't thank women enough. And I'm really sick of women who haven't necessarily been in the sex trade being put down for supporting us and called elitist, or just, you know, this word academic gets thrown around like it's some kind of insult. And I'm sort of like, hang on a minute, I want the best people possible working for us. Why not? I just appreciate it very much because everyone cops so much flack and is so easily discredited. And another thing they throw out is the religious thing. Oh, you must be some religious fruit loop and you're associated with this person and they're anti-abortion, all this kind of thing. And they just place assumptions on you. And in fact, we're an eclectic group of people who have differing political beliefs, but we have this commonality, and that is we don't want the ongoing abuse of women and children.
Thank you.
Well said, Simone. Well said, and Ellis. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so finally, Melinda, what's next for the book?
Well, the book is just, you know, rolling out. The media here has basically ignored it, but that's okay. The book's taken on a life of its own, and we're hearing from survivors who love it, you know, women that are benefiting from it, which was always the main thing. The book is now being used to help lobbying around the Nordic model, having the Nordic model established in Australia, and the French law was passed the weekend of our first ever survivor conference in Australia. So that was, you know, so encouraging, this wonderful step towards dismantling the systems of prostitution. So we're calling for the Nordic model, and we're also calling for exit programs and exposing the hypocrisy of sex industry groups being funded, where groups that want to set up exit programs to help women to get out and to have specialized counseling and rehabilitation and housing and education, help for themselves and if they have children, you know, it gets no funding. So that's a big push as well. So there's a growing movement here, finding strength and solidarity with each other, and the personal has become political. You know, we've seen that with a number of our survivors. Simone was already political, but young women like Alice and some others have now recognized that it's more than just their personal trauma and suffering that can be mobilized to political action, and that's been a wonderful thing to see.
Indeed. Thank you so much. And Melinda, Caroline, Charlotte, everyone who's listening, another thing about this book that I find wonderful, it is a very painful read and a shocking read, and you didn't edit our voices to make them more shocking or to moderate them into being more palatable. But also when people read this book, there is hope in the book as well that I think is really important, because you don't just read a collection of stories and feel despair. You read painful stories, and then there is an alternative placed in there for people. And that's what I think is a really great part about the way this book has been done, and why I love it so much and I feel so honoured to have been in it.
Well, thanks, and that means a lot. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's so great to hear. Thank you so much for all your work, all three of you, and thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for your interest and ongoing support, Megan. We're very grateful.
You just heard an interview with Melinda Tankard-Reist, Simone Watson, and Charlotte. Prostitution Narratives, Stories of Survival in the Sex Trade was edited by Carolyn Norma and Melinda Tankard-Reist and published by Spinifex Press. It's now available in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico from IPG Books in Chicago. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current.
Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.